Okay, let's, hey, do us, give us, give me the 10 count and then I'll go.
Okay, and Mark.
Yes.
Ha ha! No, we're keeping that. Hi, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode slash segment of Hav and Charles Talk Comics. I'm here with my very good friend and co-host, Charles Herring. I'm Javier Gonzalez, and today we have a special guest, and not a special guest like we've had before, no offense to Caesar, who we've known for many, many years. We have with us on the pod, let me just say this, he's an artist. He's a comic book fan. He's an all-around good person. He's a drummer. He's a comic book artist, writer. He's a human. His name is Mark Resnicek. You'll know him best as the drummer for the world-famous band, The Toadies. Everybody, Mark Resnicek is here. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the pod with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for that amazing introduction.
You're very welcome, Mark. Let me just tell everybody how this came about. I was mentioning before we jumped on the pod, I had never, as the kiddos say, slipped into somebody's DMs on Twitter. I did that. You were kind enough to respond and said, sure, I love talking comics. I'll come on the podcast. Thank you so much for doing this with us today. And let me just ask you, has anybody slipped into your DMs and asked you to be on a comic book podcast before?
Actually, yeah. But it was somebody that I knew. But yeah.
Not just some strange rando that just, I know we follow each other on, we have followed each other for a few years now on Twitter. And because of the comic book fandom that we have in common. Whoa. Comic book fandom we have in common. And now we're both on Blue Sky. Charles will fix that on the edit. I bet you he won't. Said he's trying not to laugh. It's okay, man. You can laugh. So, hey, Mark, let me just, before we get into it, in case anybody's lived under a rock for the last 30 years, so you are the drummer for the Toadies, based out of Fort Worth, Texas. That's where the band was formed, correct?
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. I joined in 1991. They had been around for a couple of years, and I was a fan of theirs in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and would follow them around and try and see them whenever I could, and then struck up a friendship with them and joined the band, and I've been there ever since.
Well, was this like a Pete Best situation where you came in and were the better drummer and you're the Ringo Starr that got somebody? I'm just curious now. I don't know. I didn't know this part.
They had probably four or five guys before me, and then to make a long story short, a friend of mine who I had been in a band with, joined the Toadies, and then she got me an audition when they parted ways with the guy before me, and they auditioned several guys, and I got the part.
That's very cool.
And you've been their drummer ever since, right?
Yep, that's right.
And the
couple years.
Go ahead.
A couple years after I joined. Then we got signed to a major label and recorded our first album, Rubberneck. It went platinum and kind of been uphill ever since.
Well, speaking of Rubberneck, I was going to say that came out in 94, and I was firmly in my college years at UT Austin and was knee deep in the whole grunge thing. Nirvana was my senior or junior year in high school. I'm dating myself a little bit. And then your album came out, and I can tell you it was in heavy rotation at every gathering amongst all the stuff we were listening to, about whether it was Alice in Chains or you know, shoot, Nine Inch Nails back then was huge, but Pearl Jam, all those, it was, and the whole album, by the way, and you can ask Charles, I listened to some music, and I especially did back then, and I'm not just blowing smoke, good, great album that you can listen to from beginning to end, so I guess thanks for that. I don't know what to say. It was awesome.
Yeah, well, thank you for listening.
So then I, you know, many years later, I get on the Twitter and I'm just trying to figure out people to follow that have a common interest in comic books. And, you know, I see posts that people are liking of yours. I follow you. And then I probably followed you for weeks, if not months. And then finally, like, let me click on this guy, Mark's bio, and just see what's going on. And then it says drummer for the Toadies. So like, holy shit. Nice. So when did the comic book fandom, can you give us a, like an origin story for yourself of when the comic book fandom started?
Yeah, sort of. I come from a big family. I'm one of seven kids, and I'm number six of the seven, so I have five older siblings, and they all read comic books. So, you know, since before my first memory, there were always comics around the house, and before I could read, I'd look at them. I'd have my mom or one of my brothers or sisters read them to me. And then when I got, you know, when I learned to read in like first grade or whatever it was, I would read them myself. But I've pretty much, you know, my entire life, I've been reading comics and still do. So, you know, a lot of times on Twitter and various places, they'll ask, you know, what was your first comic book? And it's a cool question, but I'm always a little bit sad about it because I just don't remember. It was, they were always there in my life. Like just, and you know, nobody in my family back then treated them like, I don't think anybody anywhere really treated them with the reverence or respect that as far as condition and everything, you know, they'd just be laying in a pile with a bunch of other magazines. And so, yeah, eventually I just started saving them and holding on to them. And yeah, now I got a whole fucking room full of them.
So does Hav.
Yeah, well, now they're in a storage unit. For a lot of them are in a storage unit, and I'm trying to finish out my garage. So, you know, I've put on Twitter many times. I say it's the first one. It's the first one I remember that I kept and held on to. Detective Comics. I forget what issue it is. 472. I have to look it up. It is. It's coverless. Oh. It's missing pieces of the pages are missing. I remember my grandfather. Just so you know, to swap stories, Mark. My grandfather, it was a World War II veteran. He remembered. He had told me back then that in their little care packages, they would get comic books along with smokes and other stuff. And he got comic books, and so he started getting me comic books. And that's one of the first ones. It's at least one of the first ones I remember that I held on to. It's in tatters. It's pretty much complete. But I often say it's the most one of the most treasured items I have because my grandfather back in the late 70s, of all things, bought it for me. So, but it's very cool that you grew up with them around the house. So what... because I follow you on Twitter and now Blue Sky, it seems like you're a Kirby fan, right?
I have what?
You're a big Jack Kirby fan.
Oh yeah, he's my favorite for sure.
And it looks like this is from memory. I haven't seen anything from you here specifically recently of the Western. There's a certain title of Jack Kirby Western Comics you were trying to complete a run on. Am I speaking out of school saying that?
No. Well, there are several, but you're probably talking about Bullseye, which I'm just one issue away, and I just can't find it. So eventually it'll show up. But yeah, and then Two Morrows just recently reprinted the entire run in a hardcover. So like, it seems like it always happens that whenever I'm collecting a title and I just complete it or I'm about to complete it, somebody reprints the whole thing. So I would have been happy with the reprint, but now it's kind of a point of honor that I have six of the seven issues of this title from the 50s called Bullseye. So I got to find issue number four someday.
So what kind of comic is Bullseye?
It was a Western comic that Kirby did in the 50s, a little bit of Jack Kirby history. He rose to fame in the early 40s with his partner, Joe Simon. And they were kind of like the hottest creative team in comics, like in the 40s. And on into the 50s, they They basically created the genre of romance comics in the late 40s. But anyway, by like the mid-50s, they were tired of working for other publishers and decided to start their own company called Mainline Publishing. And this, the timing was terrible because it was right when the book Seduction of the Innocent came out, and there was a huge public outcry against comic books, that they caused kids to become juvenile delinquents and so on. Anyway, this company that Kirby and Simon started, they had one war comic, they had one romance comic, they had one crime comic, and they had one Western. And each one of them, each of those series went to about 4 or 5 issues before they decided this just ain't working out. So they closed down Mainline, basically severed their partnership and went their opposite ways. But this one series, Bullseye, they had, I think, 2 or 3 more issues completed. And so they sold those to Charlton Comics. So the last 2 or 3 issues were published by Charlton, which was, anyway, that's probably more info than you needed, but it's a Western comic.
No, I love the comic history.
Yeah, so I try to get, you know, as much Jack Kirby as I can, and I have everything from 1970 till the present, basically, that he did, and then the 60s stuff with Marvel. I have as many of those as I could afford, and then I have, you know, masterworks and reprint volumes for the ones that I don't have.
Yeah, some of that would be pricey.
I don't think I'll ever afford all of them, but I have, you know, omnibuses and masterworks and all that kind of stuff to read them in. And then once you're looking at 50s and 40s Kirby, it's a little bit harder to find. Like, a lot of it has been reprinted now, actually, which is great. Now in the modern era of, you know, almost everything's been reprinted. But at the time I started collecting this title, Bullseye, it hadn't. It was like one of the few things that hadn't been reprinted in its entirety until like 6 months ago or so.
Well, I can see how you're having trouble finding, though, the actual copies of it, though. I mean, a business that closed and then sold to Charlton Comics for the last couple of issues. Which of the issues is it that you're missing?
Issue number 4.
Okay.
And I one time, maybe a year and a half ago, found it on eBay, and I bid like twice as much as I expected it would go for, and it was twice as much as I really thought I should be spending on that issue. And I still got overbid.
Oh, wow.
And that is the only time I've seen it on eBay since then.
That was going to be one of the questions I ask. If you're looking for it in the raw, like in a comic book shop, or if you're on eBay, it sounds like you're doing both. And yeah, with that kind of comic, I can see how that'd be hard to find. Speaking of Kirby, I have reprints or replicas of his original stuff that's full, bigger size. Do you, and I know they're very expensive, do you have any original Kirby artwork by any chance?
I have, now I only have one piece. I used to have a few others that I had to sell about 20 years ago when I really needed the money. But, and it hurts to this day. But I do
oh, I'm
have
sure.
One, I have one Kirby original that I'll probably never part with. It's still in pencil form, uninked Kirby pencils. It was just, I guess it was like a character study for this one-shot comic he did in the 80s called Battle for a 3D World. And it just has a couple of 2 or 3 characters that from that series, but it's like the large-sized art, like the size they drew like in the 60s before they went to the smaller-sized original art. So it's
right.
It's huge, and it's all in pencils. It's really, really cool, And yeah, it's probably the only one I'll ever be able to afford again. I bought it and the other pieces, you know, before he died, and really before the original art market kind of exploded. Pretty much anything from the 60s Marvel Comics is just unaffordable for most people nowadays. Yeah, one of the
it really
one of the
is.
Pages I sold was expensive. One of the pages I had to sell was from Fantastic Four Annual No. 4, where the Human Torch meets the Golden Age Human Torch, and it was a page that it had all four members of the Fantastic Four on it, and the Golden Age Torch, the Mad Thinker. It was a cool page. I sold it. I was really hard up for money. There was a period where the Toadies broke up for like 6 years, and I was playing in a country band and just not making much money, and I needed to pay rent and eat. So I said, well, I got to start selling some stuff. So that was one that I had to let go of, but I got like 5 times what I paid for it. So, and it, you know, it kind of saved my ass at a time when I really needed a big influx of money. So
yeah, even to this day, they are an investment. I know I bought some original. I've in the last 5-10 years looked at many different artists trying to get original artwork, and the Kirby stuff now is just next level expensive, crazy expensive. So
yeah,
I get it. And I was one of my favorite Superman artists, for example, Mark, is Kurt Swan, and trying to find an original comic book page that he did with Superman on it, forget about it. I bought one that just had a Clark Kent appearance on the page in some of the panels, and that was a little it was like astronomically less expensive than if Superman was on the page. So I went ahead and did that a few years back. And but you're right, the original comic book market has exploded. Hey, what other comic books, artists, writers, who's your, I know you probably see this all the time on Twitter and on Blue Sky, who's your Mount Rushmore of comic book creators, I guess, aside from Kirby?
Okay, let's see, Mount Rushmore. So I guess that'd be about four.
Four? Four, yeah.
Okay, so Kirby, obviously. I guess I would probably put Will Eisner up there, creator of The Spirit and the father of the graphic novel. I would say Carl Barks, the guy who drew Uncle Scrooge and all the good Donald Duck comics in like the 40s and 50s and 60s. So there's three. Who else would I put up there? I guess Steve Ditko, creator of Spider-Man and Doctor Strange and lots of others. I guess those are my top ones. I mean, there's, you know, like everybody else, there's many, many writers and artists that I'm a big fan of. But as far as ones I think that are kind of important to the field and history of comics, I maybe put those as my top four.
I like the inclusion you had there of Eisner, because that's not somebody a lot of people are going to think of in that kind of realm. But without The Spirit, I mean, there's just so many things would never have happened.
Yeah, and, you know, like when COVID happened, and like, you know, as a guy in a band, I was not able to go out on tour or go out and play shows. And like a lot of other people, I was stuck at home. So I decided I would read all of Eisner's Spirit. And I think I had read them all over the years, just in, you know, random order and stuff. But I plugged the holes in my collection to make sure I had all the reprinted stories, and just, you know, over the course of several months, I just read them all. It's just so good. The art, the writing, the everything. Like he kind of invented the language of comics, you know, made them more, used like cinematic techniques and stuff like that. And, you know, you'll find that people like Frank Miller and Jim Steranko and other people kind of learned a lot from Eisner and kind of used that as the building blocks for their own creativity. So I think he's definitely one of the most important comic creators ever. Will Eisner, ladies and gentlemen.
No, Mark, that was all awesome. Speaking of Eisner, though, the art, I know the art is amazing and definitely is timeless, I think, and holds up. The writing is another aspect of it, which I'll be honest, I have not read hardly any Spear. Do you think the stories hold up for, or is it one of those that we would say of its time, it's a good story? Do you think you pick it up today, albeit, you know where you're reading it from the 40s, for example?
Yeah, that's what's amazing about it to me, that the way it holds up, because the way he generally did the spirit stories, a lot of times the spirit wasn't even the main character in the story. He was just something there to kind of hang a story on. And so there's a lot of just kind of like human interest stories and stuff. And, you know, the spirit might show up at the end to tie things up. But there's so many, he covers so many genres, you know, over the course of however many years he drew the spirit. And it was, I should add that it was a comic book, but it was a weekly comic book insert that came in the Sunday paper. So it wasn't quite a newspaper strip because it was in a comic book format, but it also wasn't sold on newsstands. Like if you lived in a city that was cool enough to carry Will Eisner's Spirit comic book section, like you would get a new one weekly. Like, wow. Just so cool. I don't think anybody's really done that since, you know, or before.
That's really cool.
Well, and especially when you think about back then, people reading stuff, you know, comic books, picking them up and throwing them away. Newspapers back then, are you kidding? I did some quick Wikipedia reading. 1940, The Spirit debuts. And talk about something that was disposable. I mean, newspaper comic strips in an insert, and that you got to figure there aren't many of those inserts laying around, right, Mark?
Yeah, I don't think there's too many that have survived. They're out there, though. There are people that collect them and stuff. But I just bought the reprints. Yeah, he started it in 1940. And I think in 1942 or 43, he joined the Army. Eisner did. And so when he got out after the war, he started writing and drawing the Spirit again. I think while he was serving, he kind of oversaw it, but he was not the artist or the writer for 2 or 3 years there. And while they look good and they're decent, there's a definite dip in quality in those years when he wasn't on the series. And then when he came back after the war, like, his art was better, his writing was better, and just it kept just getting better. Like the spirits from like 46, 47, 48 are just, they're really unmatched for great comics. And like, unlike most Golden Age comics, like you were talking about before, you don't really have to put yourself in a certain frame of mind. Like they totally hold up as well-written stories with totally great art.
Well, hey, you also mentioned, and Charles, jump in whenever you want with a question, but you also mentioned Carl Barks, which I remember picking up some, like, Dell comics or one of those Gold Key comics that maybe were reprints of his. But there are a lot of people on comic book Twitter and now Blue Sky, like you, that give him the due he's probably deserved. Is this my ignorance? Could you just tell us a little bit about Carl Barks from your perspective and why he's on your Rushmore of comic book artists?
Sure. Like Eisner, the stories totally hold up, even though they were written in the 40s and 50s and early 60s. They're fun, but there's also like adventure, like Uncle Scrooge, you know, the richest duck in the world. He gets Donald and his three nephews, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, to go on adventures and stuff. And so for anybody that has watched the DuckTales cartoon, it started as these comic books by Carl Barks. And they're fantastic. The art is impeccable. Stories are fun, funny, well-written. He actually started off as working on the cartoons at Disney. I'm not sure if he was an animator or if he just like wrote and drew storyboards, but he actually worked on the Donald Duck cartoons. And I think at some point he decided it wasn't really for him and moved over into their comic book division and kind of became the most beloved creator. Like, I mean, I would hold up, you know, Carl Barks's Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck comics, you know, to any other comic, you know, then or now. They're just, I don't have enough superlatives to say how great they are. It's just about as good as comics get for me. Like, they're entertaining. Sometimes you'll learn something. I don't know. They're just super fun comics by a great, great, great creator.
Now, very cool, Mark, about Carl Barks. And then last, since I'm kind of going through them real fast, or not fast, Steve Ditko is somebody that purposely kept away from the public spotlight. Famously, I think we both have seen the letters that are posted on Twitter that he would write back, you know, regards Steve Ditko, where he'd print his name and then sign his name. And then, you know, like you said, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, went over to Charlton, created Blue Beetle, The Question, etc. Could you just give us why he's on your Mount Rushmore of comics?
I guess it'd be mostly because of Spider-Man and Doctor Strange, where they're just so cool looking. And he was essentially, like almost all the Marvel artists then, they were essentially writing their own stories. And then Stan Lee would take their dialogue suggestions and write his own dialogue. So I guess it'd be a little more than filling in the balloons, but really, and we don't need to get into this, but Stan Lee was kind of a credit hog, and he was the editor. So I think most of the artists figured, well, I'm getting steady work. So I guess I have to put up with this. But Ditko was the first one that said, you know what, fuck that, I don't have to put up with this, I'm leaving. And, you know, and even now, you know, I mean, Stan Lee appeared in all the Marvel movies and stuff, and he's seen as this beloved, benevolent uncle figure, you know, oh, smiling Stan Lee and all this stuff. But I kind of have a different opinion about him. Not to say that I don't love all those 60s Silver Age Marvel comics, because I love them to death with a passion. But I think the blinders had been taken off, and Stan Lee was kind of I don't want to come out and say, man, Stan Lee's a fucking asshole, but the more I learn about him, the less impressed I am by him. Despite the fact that as a person, he oversaw all those comics in the 60s that, you know, that's what I grew up on. That's kind of probably what made me fall in love and stay in love with comics. But even so, he was a credit hog, and not only credit, but he was taking money out of the pockets of people like Kirby and Ditko by taking the writing credit. He also got the writer's pay. Plus, he was on staff and getting the editor's pay. So I think everybody knows by now that Kirby was essentially writing those stories. Not essentially. He was writing them. He was plotting them, coming up with the storylines.
You mean Kirby?
Characters.
Yes.
Yes, Kirby was. Not to say there was no input from Stan Lee. None of us were there, so who knows what went on in the room. But, you know, you can compare their track record before the Fantastic Four and then the explosion of Marvel characters in the 60s. What did Stan Lee ever create?
You're right, Mark. Been people have pointed out, you know, Kirby, Ditko, especially working with Lee in the early to mid 60s into the late 60s for Kirby. And then after that, Ditko and Kirby go on to do marvelous, amazing other things. And Stan Lee, not so much, right?
Right. Well, he did Stripperella. And he did write a series for Marvel's 2099, Ravage 2099. So yeah, he created two things after he
yeah
And, you know, Jack Kirby, all the characters from the New Gods and the Eternals. And, I mean, you can go on and on. And same with Ditko. He did Hawk and Dove and the Creeper for DC shortly after he left Marvel. And, you know, continued writing and drawing comics, you know, till the end of his life. So I feel like once, like Stan Lee, you know, he's kind of said, he didn't even like comics that much. He was using it as a stepping stone to someday write the great American novel, which he never did. But all that said, I mean, you know, I still love those comics. I have friends who are even more vehemently anti-Stan Lee than I am that have said they can't even read those 60s Marvel comics because of Stan's shitty dialogue and all the crap he did. And, you know, I can't go that far. I mean, I loved him when I was a kid, when I was, you know, reading my older brother's copies of those comics and stuff. So they'll always have a special place in my heart. And that's kind of, you know, I'll give him as much of a benefit of the doubt as I can give to Stan Lee. But somehow my talking about Steve Ditko led to me venting about Stan Lee.
I think.
Well, that's okay.
Well, that's really.
Well, speaking of, go ahead, Charles.
That's kind of a common thing. If Steve Ditko comes up, you gotta talk a little bit about Stan Lee.
And then the Steve Ditko thing. Oh, sorry, the Steve Ditko thing. I was going to ask you real about Mr. A. The comic he did on his own. Did you ever read any of that? I know that's a big objectivism thing. I picked up a copy of a number one that I found in the wild years ago. Did you ever read any of that or know of any of that Mr. A stuff that Ditko did?
Yes. Yeah, I've read a bunch of them, and it's weird. I totally disagree with the objectivist and the Ayn Rand stuff. It's just... to me, it's crap, but the fact that he was so dedicated to it and so meticulous, I don't know, it's almost like outsider art or something, you know? Like, he was obviously, I don't know if obsessed is the right word, but he strongly believed in that stuff. Yeah. And honestly, if you read one Mr. A story, you've kind of read them all because it's basically all the same thing, you know? It's like putting a philosophical screed in comic book form. But some of the early ones, especially like from the late 60s, the art is just fantastic. Some of the best Ditko art, which is weird. And, you know, to get off the objectivist stuff, you can see how his art got a lot less detailed as his career went on, like into the 70s and 80s. But to me, it's still enjoyable to look at. And it's, you know, the storytelling is there. You know, you're never puzzled over what's going on in the story when he's drawing it. And the simplicity of his line, like late into his career, I don't know, I find it charming. I know a lot of people hate that late stuff, and it, you know, it doesn't hold a candle to Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. Or have you ever seen, he did quite a few stories for Warren magazines, like in Creepy and Eerie, and that is some
gorgeous
comic book art where he did some of them. He did with like kind of an ink wash technique where it's kind of looks almost painted in black and white. And those are really, you know, he was a great artist that, you know, a lot of artists, their abilities decline as they get older. It even happened with Kirby, like toward the end of his career, his eyesight was going and so on. But I still find, you know, that stuff compelling and fun and worth searching out.
Hey, Mark, you've already given us so much of your time this evening on a Friday night of all things. I just have a few more questions if you're okay to keep going for just a couple more minutes.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So we've talked a bit about, you know, the specific artists, and it sounds like you were more Marvel-centric, which me and Charles were. Any DC stuff that you think you just wanted, that you would just say, hey, this is my go-to Marvel stuff? I guess Kirby DC stuff, but anything in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I was and maybe still am mainly a Marvel guy as far as the superhero universe, but I think first and foremost, I'm probably a Batman guy, and probably like most people that are about my age, we grew up with the Adam West Batman TV show that was on twice a week at, I think, 6:30 in the evening. I remember being really little, and I'd be out, you know, like in the backyard playing, and either my mom would come out on the back porch and yell for me, or she'd send my little sister out to get me and said, "Hey, it's time for Batman." And I would run in. I would not miss the Batman show. I didn't realize that it was, you know, camp and done for humor. It was, to me, it was just, there's Batman on the TV screen, you know. That was all we had. You know, I'm like 4 or 5 years old. I loved it. And so I think my brothers were already buying Batman comics, but to this day, you know, I just love Batman. I read it all the time. So,
no, fair enough.
That would, you know, and it, Batman had a lot of the best artists that ever worked for DC Comics, like Neil Adams, Jim Aparo, Marshall Rogers, Don Newton, Gene Colan. Going back into the 50s, you had Dick Sprang.
Yeah.
I can't say his name without giggling. But so, yeah, just love Batman, all eras of Batman. I think it's awesome.
Hey,
and then, you know, I was going to say that there was a time where I was reading more DC than Marvel in the late 80s after the Crisis on Infinite Earths, and they kind of restarted all their titles pretty much, or kind of refurbished them all. And John Byrne came on to Superman and, you know, Justice League International and all that stuff. And there was a few years there where I was buying almost everything DC put out and hardly anything that Marvel was putting out.
Hey, Mark, thank you so much for mentioning Justice League International, because Charles and I have read it. I suggested we read that for one of our podcasts, and Charles liked it, but it holds such a special place in my comic book memory and heart, because I loved the comedy and the you know, the lightheartedness and fun and the art and everything about that. So just so you know, thank you. And Jim Aparo, by the way, I'm going to ask you, Jim Aparo is my Batman comic book artist, because that's who I kind of remember when I look back on Batman comics when I was of a certain age. Who is your, if you have one, who is your Batman comic book artist?
It's so hard to pick just one. It might be Jim Aparo, because when he was drawing The Brave and the Bold, that was just, he was on that title for so long, and that was kind of at the height of his, when his art was at its peak, like, I think, like in the early 70s to about 75, where it was just so well drawn. But, I mean, I can't not mention Neil Adams, who kind of set the industry on fire, and the Batman stories he did with, especially with Denny O'Neill, kind of set the template for the Batman that we still have nowadays. Kind of, they swept out all that camp stuff that had been in the comic books since the TV show, and even before the TV show, like in the late 50s, early 60s, when Batman was fighting all these weird aliens and stuff like that. Now, I still love all that corny, weird stuff, but, you know, when Neil Adams came and drew a very realistic-looking Batman, and every scene was at night, and heavy shadows, and a Joker who was actually menacing and murdered people. I mean, it's hard to discount the importance of Neil Adams, you know, to Batman in general, and the comics, you know, overall. So
it's interesting you mentioned all that. No, sorry, Mark, I was going to say, it's interesting you mention all that, because we just had a pod when we talked about Dark Knight Returns, and I feel like that was almost like the culmination or the necessary trajectory that Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams started, albeit way back when in the 70s, to 1986 when Frank Miller does Dark Knight Returns. That's a very, very good point.
Yeah, and I was buying, you know, Dark Knight Returns off the stands as each issue came out new, and it was mind-blowing at the time. You know, just Frank Miller hadn't, after he left Daredevil, he kind of kept a low profile for a while. Like, he did that Ronin series, but then he comes out with, you know, Batman The Dark Knight Returns, and it's in this cool kind of square-bound format with slick paper and everything. Like, and it was, you know, very sort of adult-themed. It was, you know, nobody had ever seen anything like it, really. And that is a good point that you brought up, that is kind of the culmination of the darker Batman that started, you know, in the 1970s. So, and, you know, for good or ill, I think The Dark Knight has kind of influenced all the Batman's comics that have come afterwards. And I don't know that that's always a good thing, because most people are not Frank Miller. So they...
you're preaching to the choir on that. We talked about that during that pod, because I feel that some of that may, not just in Batman comics, that kind of led to everybody thinking that the only good comic book is a dark and gritty comic book. And that's never been my feeling. I like those, but.
Yeah, it's not the be all and end all, you know, like there's a place for comics that are just fun, you know? So, yeah, I love The Dark Knight.
Hey,
but,
yeah, that was awesome.
Hey, Mark, one other thing I wanted to bring up, since we got you on here and we're talking comic books. You did a comic book called Buzzkill back in 2013. It was a Dark Horse title. Did you do the art? Did you do the writing? I want to say you did the art. Or am I completely wrong about that?
No. You are completely wrong about that. No. It was, I was the co-writer with Donnie Cates. That was his first series, and then the artist was Jeff Shaw, and that was his first series. So I guess I discovered those guys, but we all kind of discovered each other. But yeah, so far it's the only comic I've created, but hopefully there's more on the way.
No, please. Well, you know, and Donnie Cates... Oh, go ahead.
Comic book writing is really hard. I don't think people appreciate that till they've tried to do it. I don't know. For some people, maybe it's easy. Like, Donnie has gone on to write hundreds of comics since then, so maybe it's easier for him. But for me, trying to write a comic is like pulling nails. Like, it is hard work to me.
So what's the...
What's
the premise behind Buzzkill?
Buzzkill is about a guy who, he gets superpowers from drinking alcohol. that was the initial germ of the idea. And then as I thought about it, I was like, well, if he's constantly drinking as much booze as he can in order to power up and fight crime, wouldn't he be an alcoholic? And so that was the premise that Donnie and I started with. And so the comic opens up and he's like at an AA meeting and totally depowered, like he's trying to not drink. And so the catch 22 is, you know, if he's not drinking, he's not really a superhero. And so all of his rogues gallery figure out that's the best time to come in for the attack. So I kind of, when we were plotting it out and coming up with ideas for it and stuff, I wanted to be sure that even though it's an inherently funny premise, and like anyone who's ever had too much to drink can probably relate to, you know, I'm unbeatable or nothing can happen to me, you know, you feel like you're Superman or whatever. But I kind of wanted to not make light of alcoholism, because it's, you know, there's nothing funny about alcoholism. So yeah. Donnie and I would get together to plot the issues and discuss what was going to happen. We came up with the story. Donnie would go write the script and then send it to me, and we would kind of commiserate on that, and I would fix the punctuation and spelling. And then, yeah, that's basically it in a nutshell. I blathered on a long time about it.
That sounds like
not,
a,
not at
comic.
All.
It sounds like a really fun comic.
Fun, yeah, but also.
I get you. Yeah, it's a good premise. Okay.
Yeah, you should check it out. It's available in trade paperback form.
Okay.
Just
hey, Mark. Before we go,
10-year anniversary.
Yeah, no, because it came out in 2013. Mark, one last thing before we let you go. I did also want to point out the Toadies, yourself included, of course. Y'all do an annual music festival here in DFW, if I'm not mistaken, called Dia de los Toadies, correct?
Well, yes and no. Did it for 10 years. Then we decided to put a pause on it to figure out a better way to do it because we were we weren't losing money on it. But we weren't making as much money as we were hoping for the amount of work that we were putting into it. So we haven't done one in a few years. We're talking about starting it up again, but again, trying to figure out the best way to do it. But it was fun. We picked, you know, all the artists that would play. It became like a two-day festival where the Friday night would be in a smaller, more intimate setting, and we would kind of play acoustically and get opening acts that were similar to that or would play quieter versions of their songs. And then on the Saturday would be an all-day festival with like 5 or 10 other bands. And we got to pick all the bands. We tried to keep it Texas bands, but a few times we just asked friends of ours that weren't from Texas, but we called them honorary Texans, I guess. But yeah, it was fun, and it's not dead yet, but hopefully we'll start up here soon in the next year or two.
Well, very cool. I really hope y'all are able to put that back together again, because I miss it when it was an ongoing thing, because I just wasn't going to live shows very much back then. This is all pre-COVID, but man, you all had some pretty cool lineups, including the Reverend Horton Heat and the Old 97s, Brett Miller's by himself too, and then et cetera, et cetera. So, Mark, thank you so much for coming on here and being a very special guest on Hav and Charles Talk Comics. If you got, do you have anything coming up that you, for the Toadies or for yourself that you'd like to share with our two or three listeners? I'm joking, hopefully, but do you have anything that you want to share with us?
Yeah, we have a new album that's recorded, and we're trying to come up with ways to release it because our former label went away. They decided they didn't want to be a record label anymore, so. We might end up just putting it out ourselves, or we're talking to some other labels, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, the album is done, and it was recorded by Steve Albini, who just passed away a couple weeks ago. Actually, we did two albums with him. There's one that I'm talking about, and then one that's like a secret project that we'll have to finish without Steve, since he's no longer with us. So anyway,
my condolences, Mark.
Yeah, it was a shocker because we were just up there recording with them in April. So yeah, I could not believe it. Still can't. I couldn't believe that we were actually recording with him in the first place, and then to find out that he passed was pretty sad. But anyway, sometime in the next year, there will be a new album by the Toadies recorded by Steve Albini.
That's awesome.
Well, hey, Mark, again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And hey, if you ever want to jump on in or suggest something for us to talk about, you let us know. But again, thank you so much. I cannot tell you how much we appreciate this.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me. And it was fun talking to you guys.
Thank you very much.
Hey, and we'll let you know when the I'll message you, email you. We'll email you when the episode's going to drop, and or we might have this as a separate standalone. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
All right, sounds great. All
right. Thank you very much.
That was fun.
Yeah, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mark. You have a good rest of your Friday night.
You too.
Bye.
Bye. Hi, everybody. I just finished editing this podcast, and I wanted to add a very special thank you to Mark for joining us on the pod. It was great to have someone on who loves comics at least as much, if not more, than me and Hav. I also wanted to thank Hav for having the idea to ask Mark to be on the pod and the guts to just slip into his DMs to ask. So thank you, Hav, and as always, thank you to all of you who listen, and we'll talk to you next time.